Welcome to yet another episode of the Vikingology podcast,
which is the art and science of the Viking Age.
And today we have an interesting guest, a bit of a divergence from our typical roster. We have Ian Sharp, who is the author of The Vikingverse, which is a popular series of books that focus on a divergent timeline of history, which is to say it focuses on stories that take place in a world where Norse mythology was not overtaken by Christianity. I wonder what Anders Winroth would think of this stuff. But yes, yeah, so and it's all they're novels, but they also have a lot of great artwork associated with them. And if you poke through the site, it's something I encountered. Gosh, how long ago did you write these? I think when you first published, I ran into them.
Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's ongoing, right? So the first one, the All-Father Paradox novel, was 2018. And then the most recent thing is actually a role-playing game in the form of, you know, kind of Dungeons and Dragons, and that is hot off the press. And there's kind of comics and Old Norse phrase books and extra novels all in between. So it's a saga all of its own.
I feel like COVID really time warped us. I lost 3 years somewhere in there, because when you say 2018, I'm like, that feels like it was just yesterday.
Yep. I know exactly what you mean. No, it was writing stuff and publishing stuff during COVID was super interesting as well, right? Because in theory, people were meant to be buying more books. Perhaps they did buy some of your books. I see, you know, you sell thousands by writing real history. Writing alternate history tends to put a crib in your audience, put a dent in your sales numbers. People like to know about the real stuff, not stuff that I've just made up in my head.
Well, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because in theory, people should have been buying more books during COVID.
Yeah.
Strangely, COVID annihilated my book sales.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
2019, it was just this upward graph where it's like, I get to quit my day job and I get to be a writer full time and it's going to be great. And then in the heart of COVID, I mean, it kept going, but it just, once it hit the peak, and then book two came out, which brought the peak back. And each time I released a new book, it'd bring it back a little bit, but then it just kind of kept sliding and sliding and sliding. And I have no way to explain it. I thought, gosh, people should be reading more and more books. Why isn't this happening? Well, here's what happened. I think more people were at home, so more people were writing books, because the genre that I was in, where, you know, there were four or five of us, now there's like 200 people who have written books and thrown them into the fray, and so it's just a saturated market.
So have we reached peak Viking? Is that what we're at?
I think we reached. Well, you know, I think the Viking show went out, and that. As far as I can tell, the buzz is less. I think we've gone the way of vampires and werewolves and Harry Potter, where it's just kind of ebbing.
If only we could combine them all into vampire, Viking, werewolves, and you know, have some kind of crossover. That works for Marvel. Works for Marvel.
It sounds like, in the genre that you're working in, it sounds like that's certainly absolutely what you could do.
Sure. You're right. To an extent, you know, drawing on the myth, which is the bedrock of all of the kind of fantasy that is out there, right? Norse mythology is the wellspring from which it all derives. And so, yes, you can absolutely do that. But congratulations on the podcast. There was it was a great name. Vikingology. There was
Thank you. I will take credit for that.
You probably don't know this because you're haven't hung around British television as much as I have, but there was a famous ad campaign for British Telecom, which is the big British telephone company, and it was, "Ooh, you've got an ology." Anology was like how highfalutin, how distinguished, oh, how fancy pants are you with your ology? And now there is one in Vikingology. So I'm delighted to be here and to bask in your reflected glory.
We're the smart Vikings.
Thank you.
Come on.
The smart Vikings. There you go. Exactly. Well,
I should have a tie.
Yeah, that was. I mean, that's one of the interesting misnomers about the whole Viking Age, though, right? I mean, everyone likes to go with the tropes about bloodthirsty barbarians, but then they miss out the great skaldic verse and the literary traditions and the skills in shipbuilding and ornamentation of jewelry. There's Vikings were inherently smart.
Yeah, and I don't even know, CJ, have we ever even talked on the show about like how we met? I mean, the popularity of the Vikings in my classes, I mean, still to this very moment, this is the history class that fills up and gets a wait list before anybody else. But one of my students was using CJ's essays in their research, and I was like, all right, who's this dude? You know, it's like looking it up to make sure that he's appropriately academic for my students to be using as a source, and then found out he lives like 3 hours away from me.
and has the same birthday, right? Has the same birthday. Yes! That's uncanny.
Yes. And then I'm like, all right, we should just do a podcast and just talk about Vikings, and then here we are, like a year and a half later.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. And do you give out Vikingology diplomas? I feel something suitably carved in the bark of an ash tree would be good.
Well, we have some ash on our farm. I think I could manage that. My husband would be happy to cut it down. He's allergic to ash trees, so he would be happy to get rid of that for our swag.
Say authentic and Yggdrasalian.
That is
the right adjective, but it's one that I'm going to use on a daily basis from now on.
Well, good.
That'd be nice to have someday have a podcast where we're talking to somebody and then they have just a Vikingology rune stick in the back. You know, you passed Vikingology University.
Yes. it worked for Donald Trump.
Oh,
yes, it did.
I shouldn't have necessarily.
Well, I do know that Matthias would be happy about your premise of Christianity never having come into Scandinavia, right?
I do come across. I don't know if I've spoken to him directly, but some of the guests on your podcast certainly have traded emails with. I'm fairly sure I've come across or talked to Matthias, because when I was doing Old Norse of modern times, we've talked about the Norse names for constellations, right?
Yeah, because I did notice his name was in your acknowledgements.
There you go. So that's where that connection came from. So in my quest for authenticity and to make sure that I'm not straying too far from the guide rails of what was when trying to come up with this notion of what could have been, I have talked to a lot of academics. I've certainly read all of their stuff. I do spend an awful lot of time down kind of Alice in Wonderland style rabbit holes, looking at obscure PDFs and 18th century text, just to see if you can tease out nuggets that will make for an intriguing story, right?
So why are you doing this? What was your sort of first foray into nerding out on this?
And now you sound exactly like my wife. Why are you doing this? Why?
Why? It wasn't an accusation.
Sure. I mean, I'll give you a sensible answer. So I was always fascinated by, you know, the alternative history, and you might have come across as real historians, Arnold Toynbee and his forfeited birthright of the abortive Scandinavian civilization, which is an appendix in his expansive study of history. Right? I mean, I don't know how many volumes that goes to, but that was considered the first kind of uchronic, by which I mean, you know, kind of alternate history, parallel timelines, that kind of thought experiment. And again, you're the academic, so you tell me, but if you posit different kind of realities or alternatives to the path that history wove, then you get to see the impact of certain decisions or certain events, and you, by watching them play out in different ways, you get to understand their magnitude, their import, and their impact. So I've got lots of what if books downstairs from military historians about if a battle had gone a different way, or if, you know, someone hadn't been born. You know, where there's always that. There's a Doctor Who episode. See, a big, again, that's another part of the DNA, right? Doctor Who and that time travel. But there's a Doctor Who episode where, you know, it's called, I think it's called Let's Kill Hitler. And they go back in time and, you know, and what happens if you kill Hitler? These kind of thought experiments have always been core to any debate. And so I kind of got wrapped up in that, in those notions of counterfactual history, looking at Toynbee, looking at this stuff. And that was what got me into it, I think. And then there's a more personal dimension as well, because one of the key motifs about Norse mythology is this ever-present Ragnarok, right? The threat, the looming doom of the gods that is always on the, in some kind of unforeseen future, or you know, they know it's coming. It's always there. It's always lurking, right? And so I had my own personal Ragnarok when I was starting to write those books in 2016, which was a combination of things like Brexit happening, things like Trump getting elected, things like my own, you know, my day job collapsing, a company I ran collapsing because of a combination of, you know, fraudulent investors and narcoleptic Koreans. That's a different story. Anyway, so this Ragnarok, that, you know, it just made me think, what if you could have a do-over? What if you could start again, like as they tell it in the Völuspá, right? It starts again. Okay. Admittedly, potentially with a Christian overtone, but that starting again, combined with that what if premise that's doing so well for Marvel these days, that's what I kind of just glommed together. And then I sat down and, much to everyone's surprise, 6 months later came up with a book.
This is a great follow-up to the conversation we had with Matthias, because
Matthias,
whatever. Yeah. I'm French, I don't care.
I'll say with the English.
Sorry, Matthias. Sorry, Matthias. French. and he watches the show too, so he's gonna be like, oh. Yeah. So, but anyway, we talked about the psychologization. Boy, I can't talk today. That's that 5 month old.
But the structuralism stuff.
When I talked about Jung and Campbell, and he's not a fan because he feels like that is too rigid of a structure. That tends to overlook the nuances that lead us to understand some of the deeper meanings behind the myths, which is really interesting. But here we have, you know, a more of the kind of the point of view that I take, which is kind of that, to your point, Ian, the story as a metaphor for our natural processes moving through life. Kind of like how the hero's journey is essentially a structure, a process of change, explaining here's this process of change. We have a problem, we're called to action, we cross a threshold, we go, and then here's the psychological change that comes as a result of, you know, these steps, right? So Ragnarok as this end point, and then, but it's also it's a death and rebirth in the hero's journey. It's called apostasis, right? And so Jesus on the cross, Ragnarok, something that's echoed in all mythology. So it is interesting to me because as a writer, going through my books, I feel like I go through this process every time I write a book because it's hard. It is not an easy endeavor. And so there's just kind of this process of, oh, I need to write this book. And then there's, you know, and then I kind of follow the process. And then at the same time in the book, I'm following that process for all of my characters because that's what makes good character development. But it's fun to hear that you know, as you were writing this, it's kind of the genesis of your work has its root in sort of that parallel, right?
Yeah, and funny you use the word genesis. I suppose it's an obvious word to use in this sense, but literally, the first book starts off with an exploration of the Bible and the roots of myth, because it goes, you know, predates Christianity. It becomes stories that were told, you know, in windswept desert camps, right? And it comes from Zoroaster, and it comes all the way through the Persian Empire and the fire gods and the temples that those guys had, and then it ends up with, you know, kind of swirl of the Middle Eastern religions. Christianity comes from that, merges with the stories of the Greeks and Romans, and then at the end of all of that, this Norse mythology kind of pops up, and it must have synthesized some of it just because of the nature of human storytelling, right? It's so there is a commonality in how we tell these stories, and there is a commonality in what we now call tropes. But as those Northmen met the Roman legions and became their mercenaries, they must have picked up things that then they overlaid on top of their religion and informed their heroic characters.
I would say definitely, right? Because of the nature of polytheism, and we know that so many of those systems were perfectly fine with just sort of admitting one more god. I mean, it didn't really matter to them. And we know the Scandinavians were the same way. So, you know, no harm, no foul, you know?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, just to extend that a little bit further in the context of what I'm doing now, which is the role-playing game. So have either of you ever dabbled in Dungeons and Dragons or anything like that? Do you?
He does.
A big D&D guy. Yeah, we do it every Saturday. Okay. Yeah.
Well,
in fact, good. I'm planning a one-shot this weekend because one of our guys can't be there. So, and it's going to be fabulous.
Well, do you DM or play?
This will be my first time in the driver's seat. I'm kind of new to the Dungeons and Dragons thing. So we've been on a campaign for the last 2 years or so. I have some friends who, I finally found somebody who invited me to be part of a campaign, you know.
I sent you my rule set, right? I sent you my RPG book. If I didn't, then I'll do it immediately after this. I'm fairly sure that I did, but it's all fine. We'll remedy that because we need to get you switched out of Dungeons and Dragons into playing a proper Viking-esque game. Anyway, but my point was going to be this, is that so the setting for When the Wolf Comes, which is the title of the RPG, and as you know, that comes from Odin's famous phrase for Ragnarok, which is that all of the warriors that he assembles for those end times, they will seem too few when the wolf comes, right? And I just love that that futility of, you know, he knows he's assembling all of these warriors. So in what you were just talking about there, that great heroic tradition, that epic tradition, that hero's journey, it's fascinating to me that you know that, contrary to all of the ways that Hollywood and, you know, most books work these days, you know that it's just going to end on a bum note. You know that you're going to get eaten by the wolf. You know that you're going to assemble all of your great mercenaries and heroes, and you're still going to fail. And, you know, we just wouldn't tell that story these days. And same with role-playing games, right? Role-playing games, Dungeons and Dragons, things like that. They put the characters in the seat of heroes to try and avert catastrophe, to save the world. That's what they tend to do. And they might do it on the small scale. They might save the village, a la the Seven Samurai or the, you know, the Magnificent Seven. And eventually they go and save the kingdom from the dragon or what have you. But in Norse myth, that doesn't always tend to pan out. So I just like the in my setting, when the characters are playing, inhabiting this world where the Vikings rule the sea and stars, and Christianity was put to the Viking sword 1,000 years ago and so doesn't exist. It's a pagan present that the characters inhabit. And my point was going to be just to, you know, to take those kind of religions further. If you play D&D, you're probably a, you know, you've come across religion, you're probably a priest of Helm, or they even have Thor in there, and they have a very they have a very simple view on religion. You are a cleric of a certain god. And that's not how the Norse did things at all, right? They were very open, as you know, you just said, Terry, to kind of embracing the deity of the day, whoever they needed to. And so I wanted to take that notion and not only just have a pantheon for people to be involved with, but also to look at the you know, if you're going to invoke a god, you invoke the one that's most applicable to you that day. But also the gods, in the same way as that they synchronized for the Aesir and the Vanir, just they, as the Norse take over the world in my setting, you know, they come across things like, just same as the British came across the Indian subcontinent and formed the Raj. When the Vanir worshipping people come across the Indian religions, the Vedic religions, there's a lot of synchronicity that can come from that, like vegetarianism, like the worship of sacred cows. You know, we've got the cosmic cow, Audumbla, right? So I start to blend these religions in my pagan present. So it's not just as simple as, I worship Thor, I have a hammer. It's much more blended, because I think that that is much more realistic. 1,000 years after Christianity goes on the decline, there's all of these other religions that would have continued to influence the Norse religion. Polytheism is a broad church and just absorbs it all. So I love playing around with that. So don't know if you've got any clerics in your party on Saturday, but you should tell them that they need a more authentic form of God bothering.
It's funny that you should bring that up, because our cleric is having a spiritual crisis and is at odds with her deity. And so, and we're dealing with the consequences of that in my character.
There you go. There
you Melanos go. The Fantastic, who is a druid, and he should have been a bard. And so we're actually going to Gandalf him. So he's going to have a death rebirth.
He's going to come back in a different color. Is that
pretty much? Yeah. As a bard, it's going to be great. But anyway, yes, it's a fun game. Yeah. I do have a follow-up question. This is interesting, just to go down that rabbit hole, because you're talking about the blending, right? The commonalities between, say, Norse paganism and then some of the beliefs in India, and then you're kind of blending all that into modern paganism. What have you landed on as far as your synthesis of what it would look like in a personal, spiritual, what's the right word? Relationship with these deities, if you have so many. I've always wondered about this, and because, as you said, like the Vikings could move around, or I'll say Viking Age Scandinavians to be a little bit more precise, but they, sure. You know, it was who's the deity du jour, kind of like Harold Clack, who converted to Christianity so that the Franks would help him fight his half brother for the throne of Denmark, or it wasn't Denmark yet, but anyway, it's so, you know, they could kind of shift around. So you think of monotheism of like, here's this all powerful deity that kind of explains, you know, like God's will, and kind of helps you along that way, right? And then the I think fatalism, or the idea of fate, where like, you know, there's nothing you can do to go against your fate, but in that structure, the gods are just as susceptible, or are just as entrapped by the threads of fate, right? Everyone. So how does that look in like somebody's personal life and how they move through the world? Like what did you land on, really? Or how did you go about exploring that question of like how that would differ in terms of their relationship with both the deity and then the world around them?
Okay, so props. This was the first book, right? All Father Paradox. And I'm going to use that to explain an answer to your question. So that is a pun on the grandfather paradox. Right, so All Father is Odin, obviously, as we know. The grandfather paradox is that temporal paradox that occurs when you go back in time, you kill your grandfather, so therefore you can't have been born, so therefore you can't go back in time and kill your, and it creates this cyclical loop. right? And a cyclical loop that again has parallels with that Ragnarok cyclical loop that we've talked about, cycle of rebirth, that journey of that's so prevalent in many religions. So the basic premise to unlock the Vikingverse, the alternate timeline that I write in, is that Odin decides that he really doesn't want to face his fate. He really doesn't want to go into the moors of Fenrir, the moor of Fenrir. And so he does whatever he can to rewrite history and defy the norms. We know that Odin is a knowledge seeker. We know that he is a sorceress. We know that he is wily and not beyond pulling off a stunt. So the premise is that he rewrites history. He arms the Norse back in the reign of Charlemagne, and so fends off the nascent Holy Roman Empire, Charlemagne's empire, and if things slowly grow from there, so that by the time you get to the what we now know as the Kievan Rus and the Mongol invasion there, and I know you did something recently about the Mongol attacks on your podcast, right? But you got this great horse archers meeting shield wall, because the Kievan Rus isn't a satellite state of the distant sons of Scandinavia. It's part of this proto-Norse empire modeled on King Canute's great North Sea empire, right? So it's expanded. Odin has facilitated all of this. He arms the Rus in Kiev, or Kurnegard, as the Norse would have called it, with gunpowder, fends off the Mongol horde, history changes again. So there's all of these points of divergence, all of these tipping points where history continues to go in the favor of the Norse. So in terms of the deity du jour, the person pulling all of the strings in the Vikingverse, in defiance of fate, in defiance of the norms, is Odin. And the characters in the books who, there's a church warden from our timeline, who is the church warden of a church in the north of England called Gosforth, where the Great Cross is, which has again got its tellings of Ragnarok carved in it. So we use that as the motif to anchor all of this. And, so as the timeline blur and the Vikingverse takes preeminence down to Odin's machinations, it's then a tussle between people who, worship Christianity and are part of our society and universe, and then this new pagan present that starts to emerge. And again, just like that grandfather paradox with competing cyclical twists of fate, that's what I try and portray with these parallel worlds. And Odin is the person who's putting the strings between all of them.
Oh, I see. So there is a focus on one deity, essentially.
There is, in the sense that I don't really make it clear. The gods have never been found, right? The Nuahaima, the nine home worlds, exist cast as exoplanets rather than that kind of concertinaed world of Norse myth. So I've cast it wider. And mankind looks for the fingerprints of the gods. They find them in all, or they imagine they find them in all kinds of settings. But I also kind of take a more Nietzschean view that, man is God to man, man is wolf to man. That ties back with the Ragnarok stuff. So literal deities, literal divine powers are are impossible for mortal man to pin down. They might, pray to them. They might extol their virtues. They might call for intercession, but they'll have a hard time of it because the Norse gods are fallible, almost human in their ineptitude, and so they remain unfound and actively hidden in the case of Odin, because he doesn't want the Norns to come knock on his door and rethread fate the way that it's supposed to be. I mean, there's that famous phrase, right? None outlive the night the Norns have spoken. Odin wants to avoid going the way of the wolf.
So this is the kind of thing I can imagine in my class, where apparently my students are going to come to me and be like, okay, I read this book, The Allfather Paradox. So how real is this to the real history? So they're going to want to parse that out. They do it with the Marvel movies. They do it with everything. It's like, oh, but I thought it was this. Like, no, it's not that. Well, then why did they write it like that? Well, I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's where I was talking about earlier, about that kind of quest for authenticity, right? Because you've got to have it rooted in real history for it to make sense or have any resonance. So Toynbee, we talked about earlier, is a good example of that, because he talks about the fact, well, what if the Norse hadn't been bought off at Paris or London? What if they had managed to take Constantinople, Mikregard, because they were close in all of those times? What if becomes, well, you can see how that would have had a knock-on effect. What if Leif Erikson hadn't have turned up in Vinland as an exile from a kind of colony from a backwater that was having a tussle with the homeland in Norway, right? Is by all of these steps removed. What if he had the resources of Canute's North Sea Empire behind him? Then, the name Columbus wouldn't be on anyone's lips. It would be, a fully financed and equipped colonization in, the 10th, 11th century. And you could see that kind of happening if history had gone a different way. If I was talking about this as a point of counterfactual history with someone on Discord the other day, we all know, Constantinople, the biggest city on the world. That's why they called it Mikregard, right? The great city. And the Greeks there, the Byzantines, they defended themselves famously with Greek fire, whose recipe has been lost. The recipe for Greek fire was lost perhaps in the 11th or 12th century. Let's imagine that, the Oleg and the Rus or whatever permutation of Norsemen were successful in taking over Mikregard, then they would have perhaps inherited the secrets of Greek fire. If you got Vikings with Greek fire, which is potentially possible within the timelines we talk about, imagine what that might have achieved in terms of accelerating world dominance. And so, there's all of these points that are just worth pursuing. If the Danelaw had persisted and grown, and Alfred the Great had died at Chippenham as opposed to escaped to fight his battles, what would a North Sea Empire have done with the riches of England at its command, in addition to the innovations of Scandinavia?
So I think it would be important then, because I actually was just talking about this in one of my other classes this week, yes, 2 days ago, that, so just kind of back up and contextualize this for our audience, to talk about, sort of in the Venn diagram of like, here's just utter and complete sort of made up fantasy over here. Here's, what we know of what happened in the real history here. And so the Venn diagram where those things sort of intersect. that there is this thing, and you've used the phrase a couple of times, that is part of, you know, the historiography now in a more legitimate way, and that's called counterfactual history, this idea of looking at the what ifs, which traditionally prior to, I don't know, just, you know, maybe a few years ago, you know, most of the sort of, you know, academic, you know, stuffed shirts kind of historians would just sort of look at that and kind of scoff at it, like, what's the point of that? You know, why even care about looking at that? And like my husband always says, well, if ifs and buts were candies and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas, you know? So it's like, who cares? Whatever, you know, it's like just this thought experiment that doesn't really end anywhere. But that counterfactual history, as it has become more sort of kind of mainstream as far as a way to look at things, is that it's important to understand that, you know, this kind of exercise actually helps us understand the way it did turn out, by, you know, looking at all of the other paths not taken. Generally speaking, most, I think, historians, at least that I know of, that are, you know, into counterfactual history, they would only allow you to sort of look at the paths that actually would have been available to those people at that moment, and then just say, well, if they did this rather than this, and then you can kind of explore and then see. Because what happens, and this is the thing I was sharing with my students a couple of days ago, is that, you know, when it comes to these big kind of events that changes things, and I think, what was I talking about? Maybe the Enlightenment or something. But anyway, is that, or yeah, the American and French revolutions and such, where it's like, you know, it's very, very difficult for us this far in the future to get into the headspace of like their, you know, sort of going into this thing that is going to be game changing, but they don't know that. Right. I mean, they don't know how this is going to turn out. The American Revolution. What if the Americans didn't win? Right. You know, kind of thing, which is, you know, the whole point of asking these questions as counterfactual. But, you know, so we've got the benefit of hindsight being 2020. We see how it worked out. And then so therefore, we just sort of write that history. Whereas, you know, if you're really going to try to inhabit the space, and this is the thing, and CJ's heard me say this before, that I always try to hammer into my students, like, if you learn nothing else from my class, please understand that historical context matters. And so to try to get into that historical context and the headspace of those people to be like, all right, now here's the, you know, the various paths that you're being presented with, pick one, but how does it feel, you know, to do that and to not know how it's going to turn out? And like, we all are operating in our lives that way every single day, right? With every choice each of us makes about something, there's a plethora of parallel universes that don't happen.
And yet, people are fascinated by it, right? Yeah, I mean, it's the sliding doors.
Right.
You know, people love that idea. And, you know, and I think it's a, going back to books, it's a literary motif as well. I mean, you only have to think of, you know, to piggyback on what you were just talking about, the path, the road not taken, the Robert Frost poem, right? You know, yes. Two roads diverged. And that's, and so it's not only historical, it's literary to posit these different potentials. And I think it's fascinating how all of that goes together within the context of Norse myth. You know, I know enough about history to be dangerous. That's my problem. Enough, you know, it's, I haven't anything like you know, your academic expertise. I know enough to throw some stuff together in a vaguely plausible way, partly because it's entertaining.
Yeah, entertains
me anyway.
Yeah, well, that's usually how I describe my approach to history. I know enough to be dangerous.
Yeah, and then to go back to what you're going to be doing at the weekend. I mean, you've presumably got elves and dwarves. There's a kind of counterfactualism at play there as well, right? Because Alpha and Verga, the original constructs for these, just were morphed by either Christianity, who made Alpha the little fairies at the end of the garden, and Dvergar the things that inhabited the stones in Iceland, you know, and then Tolkien lays upon it as well and makes them pointy-eared and gives them bows and this, and all of that is just looking at stuff through a different lens, so that we get a very rich tapestry today, where Amazon has got Lord of the Rings all over TV, and we've got these this cultural understanding of these mythical beings. We've got Marvel's Thor and Odin, and they're all kind of, if you think about it, very strange twists on what originally existed, what was originally in the minds of those of the people who came up with them, who conceived them, who engaged with the land spirits on a day-to-day basis. So I think that's fascinating as well, to try and strip back. You were talking about there, you know, the thinking. We can't ever fully know what was in the minds of people a thousand years ago. I mean, I'm sure you've read Neil Price's books about these things that kind of pry into the Viking mindset as best possible. But again, I just think it's a fascinating exercise to just to look at that structure, look at the worship, look at honor, look at shame, look at crime and punishment, and put all of that in the context of trying to create a realistic environment for people to either read the books or play a role-playing game that isn't Tolkien-esque and, you know, has got short, stunty dwarves.
So what about the issue of, because I think about this a lot, and actually just talked about this with my Viking class yesterday, looking at Vikings in the modern era. The idea of playing with history, which human beings have done forever, sometimes people like to say revisionist history. Well, that's been done for, since humans started writing history. There's reasons why we write and rewrite.
The victor writes history, right?
Right. Well, and so the idea, like what I stress to them is that, because the Viking Age is ripe for this, right? Because we have sources, but there's problems with the sources. They're either written by outsiders, they're written by Christians about pagan things.
Yep.
They're not written by Vikings themselves, other than, cryptic runic inscriptions or whatever. So, when we have gaps in sources, like I always say to them, we're none too happy to just fill ourselves into the gaps. And so that's fine. And as far as I'm concerned, as a hopefully, kind of a responsible historian, it's like, I don't mind when people play with the past. It's just, I would just like them to just make sure they're acknowledging the difference, because we do then, part of our talk yesterday was about the latching on to the Nordic myth by, from Hitler onwards, to sort of these alt-right groups or white supremacists or whatever, where they're doing basically the same thing. They're playing with history and they're picking out the parts they like, and they're, using that to the ends that they think are necessary for them. But, clearly that's different than just sort of playing D&D or, doing some kind of fantasy thing for fun. I mean, it gets into the realm of more serious. And so I'm just kind of interested in your thoughts on that, of when you're playing with history, but it can be dangerous.
Yeah, it's actually a very good point. I ran some Kickstarter campaigns for the RPG, and I put a big logo across the top: neo-Nazis need not apply, because this is a particularly fraught area. And again, to contextualize this, I mean, we all know that the Nazis have tried to appropriate Norse myth and Norse artifacts and portray themselves as gods in or heirs to the gods, right? It was bound up in their propaganda, the SS posters, the runes, all of that kind of stuff. So I'm sure your readers, listeners are familiar with that. But in the context of then writing a pagan present where you don't touch upon that at all is a little bit dishonest, disingenuous, right? Is if there were a Norse Empire, in the same way as that, whether the British Empire of the past or the American Empire of the present, or the nascent emerging Chinese Empire, they're very nationalistic, and so this isn't just looking at, I created a Norse timeline with inventions and changed the names. So, Henry Ford inventing the car becomes Heinrich Fjord, who then he invents the, you know, et cetera, right? So I created a Norse timeline based on invention and events, but also you have to look at the big sweeping epoch-changing movements like nationalism. So the future Norse empire of my world isn't a particularly nice place. They have stamped their heavy feet across everyone from, you know, from 1,000 years ago, what they termed the Skraeling, the North American natives, all the way through to the various other nations of the earth, to eventually the point where, because thraldom still exists, a la the kind of the Russian serfdom is an analog there, right? So by the time it gets to my in-world equivalent of the Great War and the Russian Revolution, there's a similar Great Thrall uprising, which then is people trying to throw off the shackles of their overlords, and you have demagogues and you have iconoclasts and all of these competing forces, when nationalism becomes a key part of that and religion becomes a key part of that. And so what I'm trying to drive at is you can't ignore that kind of natural tendency, as I've just said previously, for man to be wolf to man. The many perils of our history and what we can learn from it is that we're always the ones at fault. You know, we're always creating our own conundrums and perils. We're the architects of Ragnarok. And you just need to look that in the face. So while I don't have any truck with neo-Nazis and their bizarre ideology, that bizarre fringe ideology does power some events in the books and the RPG that are effectively the equivalent of, in D&D terms, you've got the evil wizard in the tower and you have to deal with him. Well, in game terms, you've got the slightly lunatic fringe who are trying to bring about the end of the world because they think that Ragnarok is a good thing. And so you have to defeat them. So it's all about how you cast your villains and foes and who your evils are. I also play around with the Sons of Ivaldi. The Sons of Ivaldi are in Norse myth are the architects of all kinds of weapons of mass destruction, right? Including Gungnir, Odin's spear. And so I cast them as these kind of, I don't know, almost Elon Musk style figures questing for life and eternal life and riches and their weapons merchants. And they help bring about Ragnarok in the same way as that, you know, they give the gods their weapons. They give the wrong people weapons of mass destruction and things go awry. So again, it's trying to get the myth and project it in a way that is authentic, believable, but also rooted in those archetypes from the past.
So I have a rabbit hole that I'm going to go down, if you'll entertain me for a second. just thinking about this idea of divergent history, which is interesting because I feel like it's and I'm gonna kind of go into that psychologize kind of a vein here again, looking at the past and saying, you know, what are the pivotal events that had they been different, or has some small detail changed, the entire course would be different, right? And then what events are those, we'll call them catalysts, and what what parts of those events were just part of the rolling tide of the inevitable, that are part of a larger theme. So I think it's an attempt to try and figure out, you know, I like the forest, you know, the trees in the forest and looking at the whole forest kind of idea. And to me, I'm finding a little bit of irony in this idea that it's a little bit like, from a modern lens, it gives us a sense of someone back then was in control. I think because today we all feel like we lack control because the world is this relentless rolling tide. In fact, there's
that's exactly right.
Yeah, Robert Sapolsky just came out and said there is no free will. He's a neuroscientist, and he's controversially come out and said, no, there's no such thing as free will, right? And I love the example of, I was actually trying to explain this to a friend the other day, that, you know, there are decisions that we make that give us the illusion of free will, but they're inconsequential because in the broader scheme, we're just following this larger tide, right? And the example I gave was, you know, okay, so let's say today at 10:06, I'm going to get hit by a bus, right? But at 9:04, I go into a smoothie shop and I get to choose if I get a vanilla or a chocolate smoothie, which flavor really doesn't matter because I'm still going to get hit by a bus at 10:06. But the illusion is that I have some sense of control. I feel like, so it's almost an exercise in just entertaining this idea of, was there a pivotal moment where someone could have made a different decision, thereby giving them the power to alter the course of history? Or are we looking at, and I find where the irony is in this is, we are also talking about a society that, by all intents, is from an outside view, fatalistic, which is to say, they thought that fate was inevitable, and they understood this inherently, where, you know, you can go hide in a hole, or you can go out and do great deeds, but the manner and time of your death is already determined. Right. So we're kind of I'm finding a little bit of fun in this idea of using actually the Norse as the divergent history to kind of entertain these ideas. I hope all of this is making sense. All that to say,
it makes perfect sense. And yeah. and I think that is the fascinating part. And that's where I think Odin is the perfect person to change things and pull the strings and go against the tide of history, because he's constantly portrayed in sources, admittedly, you know, they seem through a Christian lens oftentimes, but he's seen as this alternative Satan, right? He was demonized. He was turned into something else. I think that, you know, what you're saying about fate is fine, and the points of which are the tipping points, and your smoothie thing is valid as well. Except for this, what we're really talking about is, in Bill Murray terms, is Groundhog Day. You can keep going back, and if you don't want to get hit by that bus, just keep going back and messing with your smoothie order until you get the one that means that you don't get hit by the bus. And that's what's kind of happening in this. So to try and then pick some exact points. So this is the book, you know, all 400 pages of role-playing game. And in here is a timeline that and you'll see this a bit later on, but I'll try and show it there. There's many, many pages of timeline about, because I have too much time on my hands, and so I really came up with an entire, you know, from the, you know, the age of Ragnar all the way through to you know, the for example, one of my favorite puns is not William Shakespeare anymore, it's Valheim Shakagir, right? Because he writes not Hamlet but Amlothi. And he based Hamlet on that Danish tradition anyway. But again, everything gets Norsified. So the points of divergence, they starts with you know, things like 870, the siege of Dumbarton Rock, where they broke the Scottish kingdom of Strathclyde. And you know, in the Viking verse, things go slightly different. Not only do they break Strathclyde, but they defeat the kingdom of Elba at the Battle of Dollar. And so by the time you're getting into, we've talked about religion a little bit earlier on. There was the great East-West schism in Christianity. I play around with the idea of an Isiervanir schism. And so there's different churches emerge within this history. And so here it goes on and on and on, instead of Isaac Newton, it's Newton operating in, instead of Cambridge University, it's Cambridgia University, which would be the Norse equivalent, right? So messing around with all of that becomes increasingly sci-fi when they discover that Yggdrasil is a real godhood, and has been seeding life, so that humankind are kind of the motile hands of motile servants of this great arboreal intelligence. But that's a little bit further down the line, so we won't get into that. But in terms of all of the kind of epoch defining things, translating them, looking at them through the Norse lens, coming up with counter points and looking through that timeline, I think that that's what grounds us in our real world. It's what grounds then the alternate mythology that enables you to play an effective game, because there was no American Revolution, but there was something similar with a kind of Vinlander uprising led by someone, Vendelcro. I forget his name. I'd have to look in my book. But there's all of these things that I play with in counterfactual history. Does that answer your question?
It does. Roundabout. Yeah. It was more of a statement, and then you took it from there, which is perfect. I'm enjoying the conversation very much. I have a question that's on a different, just a different, totally different vein here. Who's your illustrator? Is it?
There's a couple, right? So the guy who does the covers of various things, this guy called Jeremy Moeller, internally, because again, in the same way as that you can play your elves and dwarves and wizards and stuff, there's all of these paths in the rule book for Path of the Wise, Path of the Skald. We don't have bards. I strip everything back to as Norse as it can get. So warriors are oathsworn. But this is a guy called Geir Kirti. And then with Old Norse for Modern Times, we messed around with those old Vendel. You remember, you've seen all of the kind of... So we just updated the Vendel art. Obviously, he wasn't carrying a suitcase in the original lithograph or whatever they're called, but that was a whole different... artist as well. So we bring in artists as we need to. The guy who did the comics is a guy called Dev Pramenek. He went on to do the Dune comics, which are obviously seeing a renaissance right now with the film. So some good guys involved over the course of the past 5 years, and it's that cartoon style, that comic style was an art choice to distinguish us from the plethora of Viking stuff that's out there, right? You talked about going from 5 to 200 authors. How do you set yourself apart? Well, by one of the ways, by having an art direction that's kind of Jack Kirby-esque, to go back into the Marvel annals. And I think that that's helped in some ways. It gives us a different look and feel that sets us apart.
Yeah, and I really enjoy the artwork. That's why I ask, because it's like, this is really talented people involved. And I was curious if you'd done some of it or if you'd had other people involved.
No. So I have to act as my own art director. I'm not sure how you do the covers of your books, but you have to have the idea and the concept. I mean, this is, you know, we all know that the cover of the Yotsenmoor here is the famous Iwo Jima, right? And so that's just the Raven banner. They happen to have hoisted it on Jotunheim because that's where the war takes place. That's where the equivalent of, you know, those battles take place. To some extent, it's pastiche. One of the other things I did actually, just while we're drifting through this, is a lot of the cover art for the individual comics was drawn from World War II posters. So there's World War I posters. So that eagle versus raven, not sure if you can see that effectively there, was a classic World War I poster where it was the German eagle, the Kaiser's eagle. I've just recast it. So the Norse raven. And then throughout, I steal speeches from, for example, you know, Churchill or something, and just Norsify them. So these are classic Churchillian or, you know, historical speeches where instead of enlist now, you know, it's the Lord Kitchener stuff that, you know, join the British army, it's more rally to the Raven banner. But the context is pretty much what they said. I've just changed it to, instead of it being attacking the forces of the Kaiser, it's dealing with cloud scrapers, shadows on the sky, the devourers, the names that the Norse gave for the Jotnar, right? So it's, again, so you start in history, why completely reinvent it when there's such a rich tapestry of stuff to pick at? And by just a simple twist, you can come up with something that is, I don't know, more compelling than I could write. As I get to synthesize all of the great minds of history and I don't know, steal their work, tweak their work.
Actually, that makes me think of something that I was going to ask you. And I tell my students, you know, like, these people lived, you know, 1,000 years ago, 1,200 years ago. Like, Vikings don't change, but who looks at them does. Mm-hmm. And, you know, history is always that way, right? It's always sort of reformed through the lens of whoever is looking. So what do you think your work says about who we are as humans, or where we are as a human society right now, in the way you're approaching it?
I've become a lot more, as I've grown older, I've become a lot more aware that the world around us is almost literally burning, right? I think that my lens partly recast the Norse as much more in tune with nature. Certainly, you know, they embraced and almost worshipped the animal forms, right? And their pagan traditions weren't edifices of stone and wood so much as natural settings. And so there's a bent throughout my portrayal that they're much more ecologically focused, and they take care of Mother Yorth much better than we take care of planet Earth. And so that's what I'm very aware of. I don't have fossil fuels in my universe, because if Yggdrasil is the deity, then, and trees are sacred, then let's not start burning things and polluting the planet, right? And I wouldn't say that I've become an eco warrior because of it, but I'm certainly very cognizant that trees are living, breathing lungs for this planet, and we shouldn't just destroy them in the name of profit. And I think that I might be biased. I might be looking at that through this lens of the kind of global catastrophe that we're enduring. But I do like to think that the Norse would have been in tune with nature enough to have not got to the kind of rapacious point that we have with our planet.
which is along the lines of what we discussed in our last podcast. And then of course, the question that I put too, but is the global catastrophe part of the relentless tide? And because I think we went down that rabbit hole of there are cycles in nature, and there have been what, five or six mass extinctions. And so if we intend to endure beyond the natural cycle, then creating an artificial ecology and removing ourselves from nature is an inevitable step, unless we decide that we
but again,
unless
it's
we decide. And that's us playing Odin, to your point, right? Like trying to cut the threads of fate, because maybe we shouldn't. The value in what we're experiencing here is to just go with the relentless tide, right?
And look, there's another Norse phrase or Scandinavian phrase that it speaks in that kind of resigned way to fate, which is there is seldom a single wave, right? Which goes to your point. There's always going to be more waves coming. Like Canute himself, you can't hold them back. That's why he sat on the beach and tried to demonstrate to his courtiers that you can't hold back the tide. You just get wet legs. And so, I think that fatalism is perhaps worth embracing, but that doesn't mean that you should just lay down and die, right? I mean, and whether it's the Klingons that have embraced that, or any of these other modern takes on Norse mythology in the sci-fi world, you fight, you battle, you go down swinging. Today is a good day to die, right? That's the if you're it's honorable to know that even if you are going to get hit by a bus at 10:06, God damn it, you're going to wear your best pants.
But that's the choice we get to make. The Star Trek reference, thank you. I'm a big Trekkie. That's I could hear Worf. Perhaps today is a good day to die.
Exactly. CJ, I feel that we've got the start of a beautiful friendship here. It's just everything is in common. Vikings,
my wife
Star Trek, D&D.
My wife literally has Star Trek Voyager on in the background right now.
That's great. That's great. I was much more of a DS9 fan myself.
I love DS9. Yes, the teleplay. It got a lot of criticism because it's not a Trek, but I was like, yeah, but the character development is so much richer.
Yeah, it is. It is. It was the first, arguably the first serialized network show to introduce long story arcs like that, right? And certainly, my Jotun War and that world is influenced by, the wars with the, the Vorta and the Jem'Hadar. Which were undoubtedly influenced by Norse mythology in the first place, right? So it's just, again, it's all cyclical. There's no such thing as a new idea, perhaps just recycled versions.
Well, I see your Space Vikings game
exactly.
Here that's new. And, well, I have bad news for you. Star Trek did it first.
Yeah, I mean, the Space Vikings expansion was an attempt to actually just put Norse warships in space and have similar slugfests, not the kind of Star Wars-esque pew pew pews and TIE fighters and Star Destroyers, but a good old-fashioned ramming action, boarding incursions, and that style of warfare just put into that kind of space context. Yeah. Again, with fossil fuels being removed from the situation, they don't have jet engines or much in the way of speed. So, it just meant for an interesting rule set that was different from the kind of sci-fi stuff that's out there.
You know, it's funny because somewhere, probably, let's see, it was right after I released the first book I ever wrote. I went back to France. And I was hanging out with one of my cousins, Alice, who's a tremendous artist. And I was actually kind of prodding around like, oh, would you be interested in doing some artwork for this book? Because I always thought my books would do really well as like graphic novels kind of thing. And she was interested. But then we went on this long tangent together, just laughing the whole way. And we came up with Les Vikings dans l'espace, the Vikings in space. And we actually came up with all these wild ideas. It sounds like you had a similar idea and then put it into Space Vikings, where, you know, take the long ships and how do you power the long ships? Well, you get all the guys on there and they row, but the actual oars are tied into turbines that then generate electricity for the ship to propel forward. And the way we had so many wild ideas for that. And I remember that distinctly, and this brings it all back where I'm like, oh, look, somebody had that same idea.
Yeah, it's well. I mean, the in writing these, I'm sure you've done something similar. When you do your research, you have to again ground it. So, in not only have I researched history, in the case of these Viking longships, I tried to do a plausible imitation of real world physics. You know, I have solar sails and worked out just how fast they would power these ships and how they would work for interstellar journeys. Unfortunately, it's incredibly slow, even at massive, even once you get enough momentum, it would take you something like 70 years to get to Alpha Centauri. I've gone down my own rabbit holes there. So that's when I came up with my version of hyperdrive or warp drive. Scotty would be proud. I came up with thought and memory drive, right? Hugin and Munin, and just the notion that Odin sends out his ravens across the world for reconnaissance to bring him back news. But thought and memory drive works in a kind of pseudo physical sense, in that if you can imagine and memorialize where you want to go, you can instantly transport yourself through the kind of the magic of Odin's ravens. And so that's how I do, is like jump drive or hyperdrive or whatever you want to call it. Mine is thought and memory drive, which is again tied to Norse myth. And so that's how I get around the fact that if you really want to go places and you can only do so with solar sails, it's going to take you more than, you know, a couple of game sessions to get there, and probably several character lifetimes.
So what's next for Ian Stuart Sharp?
Jeez, that's a good question. I'm focusing on expanding the role-playing stuff. I've got some supplements coming out, with one coming out called Paths of Honor fairly soon. So when I came up with the original character classes, there's obviously the Berserk, and there's the Wand Wed or the Velour instead of just the traditional magician or wizard, right? So I've gone this for more Norse archetypes, but I realized that I hadn't gone far enough, and so some of the classes that I've got, inspired by things like the Northman film, I want to have like a player, a baller, a sportsman, and have that as a class, and introduce the Thing Men as a class. And so Paths of Honor are all of these classes, these character paths that expand the setting, but are really, truly, authentically Norse, in the sense of, you know, the mad, bad, and dangerous to know. You know, there's a rider character class, Ridari, which is equivalent to the knight, right? But in the context of Norse myth, clearly you've got Sleipnir, and you've got their fascination with the various horses. I mean, Gandalf's Shadowfax, to go back to your earlier reference to your friend, you know, Shadowfax, again, drawn from Norse myth, right? So the Norse, while not being renowned as great cavalrymen, definitely had a tradition of horsemanship and a love of horses. So I've put that into my setting, but clearly in a kind of pseudo sci-fi setting, riding your horse into battle is very World War One, right? Cavalry charges, charge of the light brigade, charging into the trenches against tanks. Not only the premise is that only a Viking would be insane enough to lead a cavalry charge in this age of mechanized warfare. So it's honorable to do so because you're inherently going to run into a bus at 10:06. You know, that's inevitable if you're riding horse, but there's something honorable about charging headlong into your demise. So there's things like that. I like, you know, more character classes with that hopefully authentically Norse viewpoint. And that's what I'm going to be doing. At some point, I have to emulate you and, you know, do more books, more novels. But I'm having too much fun writing games. Games as interactive storytelling that you can do with a whole bunch of people. I defy you to actually say that this isn't true. Making stuff up on the spur of the moment with a whole bunch of people is actually much more fun than sitting here and typing a whole bunch of stuff into a book, right? It's just, I've got the RPG bug, and I found it much more enlivening than writing novels.
I know how you feel. my thing is, my D&D group, actually, I think everyone's involved with my business now in the D&D group in some way, shape, or form. But the DM, he's my business partner, and we launched, essentially it's a marketing agency now, but it's focused on creating compelling video. By training, he's a documentary filmmaker. He worked in LA, went to film school, you know, that real, real talented guy. Just
is he the guy that did the advert that with the
Viking
agency?
Commercial?
Yeah, with the gold on the shore. Is that the one?
Yeah, yeah. So he's actually the one with my Gurbindu helmet.
Yeah. Okay. He's not the one with the eye patch. He's the other one.
No, the one with the eye patch is that's Josh. He's a local actor. So he's pretty talented. He's very funny. In fact, I challenged Taylor. I was like, you should put him in a serious role and see how that goes. But so part of this project is because I'm the writer, and so they have me scripting and structuring story. And so, like, I created a documentary template essentially that we can then, if we go into a business or like we're doing a lot of nonprofit work right now, and you know, they go in and they do the interviews, but then I structure it so that I basically tell them, like, here's the questions that you need to ask, here's some of the things that we here are some sound bites we need to hear. But it's been so much fun scripting and then collaborating with people on getting the scripts dialed in and then going out there and, you know, kind of play, you know, and so my novel, you know, my next novel, I'm probably 30% in, and it's kind of slow going because I'm not getting to it because every time I'm like, oh, I'm going to go write Hastings 4. Yeah. And then it's like, or I could write a script for this very funny commercial.
Yep. So your progress bar, 31%. 31.2%. Yeah. No, I completely get it. The you know, striving for that, you know, tens of thousands of word count and putting out a novel, as opposed to the kind of just the collaboration and the improv that comes with RPGs.
And you're going for the dopamine hit in the short run. That's what you're doing. It's like,
Yeah, maybe, but you know, it's also, you know, we've also found that perhaps you know, the Viking novel market is saturated, and so, you know, find your niche and exploit it. And for the time being, mine is eliminating pointy-eared elves and only talking about alpha.
The whole the folk.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a pleasure. Very fun conversation.
It was a delight. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, we're always all about, like, between me teaching and CJ's books and now this. I mean, a part of our premise with this podcast was to just sort of scour the universe for all ways that people engage with the Viking past.
But so, what we should then do, I'll put it to you now, is, you know, Critical Role are doing great things with D&D. We should have a Viking actual play with all of your actors and marketing friends. We should do a live streaming when the wolf comes, authentic. You know, I made this joke actually because I took a whole bunch of National Geographic pictures from people who are reenactors, but everyone should turn up on camera, all wearing their helmets and all live play, you know, role play the session. And take on Critical Role at their own game But yeah, that's how you're going to make millions from advertising and sponsorship. We just need some big brands to sponsor the Viking Ventures.
Well, I have good news. Our agency does do live streaming. In fact, one of our guys that works for a company, he used to do live streaming for GoPro and some other big one. And then, yeah, so if we can get the sponsors, let's do it. I think that'd be fun.
Put it together. You bring your Gandalf and your pointy-eared elf, and we'll convert him to the authentic Norse tradition.
Let's do it.